AIDS brings a response from the government.
AIDS, the disease which claims life.
Welcome to AIDS Lost Voices with me, William Hampson. In this series, we journey through the decades to explore how Britain reported on the AIDS pandemic. We'll delve into the newspaper archives from the 80s, 90s and noughties, unearthing individual stories that reveal the human experiences behind the headlines. Join me as we seek to understand the complexities of a crisis that reshaped lives and challenged societal perceptions. Ready? Let's go. In all our episodes thus far, we've featured stories of the AIDS pandemic, the height of which occurred in the mid to late 1980s. However, there was a larger pandemic or plague within the same decade, often referred to simply as stigma, but more accurately given the acronym AIPS, A-I-P-S, which translates to AIDS-induced panic syndrome. This phenomena contributed to a climate of fear and misunderstanding surrounding the disease, leading to, as we all well know, widespread discrimination and social ostracism for those affected. While some may respond with laughter or dismiss it as a gimmick, AIPS was a serious and widely acknowledged concern within the scientific and medical community. As we delve deeper into this topic, it is essential to understand the lasting impact of societal attitudes during this tumultuous period, illuminating a facet of the crisis that extends beyond the illness itself. Oh, for fuck's sake, I'm going to have to stop Gloria insisting on writing my scripts. I sound like a right dick. Oh, tumultuous, illuminating. And who the feck says facet these days? And one of the first mentions of AIPS in the UK was in the tabloid newspaper The Daily Mirror on the 21st of February 1985, under the headline The Silly Sickness, where the article states, "Following the demand by a Swansea Theatre's Mrs. Mops to have gay actors banned from their stage and the boycotting of gays by tattoo artists, a fresh outburst of the very silly disease AIPS, AIDS-induced panic syndrome, has been reported from an unnamed London borough. There, town hall cleaners have gone on strike for rubber glove money because they fear that councillors handing over generous grants to gay workshop coordinators without gauze pads over their mouths may have become AIDS carriers. The council wishes to remain anonymous in case potential industrial investors in the borough are put off by rumours sweeping through AIDS-infected areas that you can catch AIDS from sitting on park benches. AIDS was first detected in San Francisco 3 years ago when hitherto sane citizens began boycotting restaurants allowing gay waiters to handle the lettuce. The silly sickness, as it is known, is believed to have been transmitted to this country on a souvenir menu. The first notified case in Britain was in August 1984 when a man addressed as, quote, "you little saucebox," end quote, by a camp actor, came out in psychosomatic boils within the week. AIPS is believed to be transmitted orally, usually by gullible or excitable persons coming into contact with persons of a similar disposition and filling their heads with rubbish. There is yet no firm evidence that it can be contracted from reading the Sun newspaper. As the AIPS plague spreads, leaders of the very silly community fear a level-headed backlash against known idiots. They insist that the so-called silly sickness is not, as is widely thought, endemic to the very silly and that they have already seen several cases of quite intelligent people catching it. Doctors stress that vulnerable persons such as prison officers and hospital workers who take sensible precautions against AIDS are unlikely to be suffering from AIPS, unless they have experienced the telltale initial symptoms of running around like a scalded cat crying, "A friend of my brother has heard of a top secret report that admits that it can be spread by sneezing and it's only a matter of time before we're all dead and the government can do nothing about it, apparently." Though there is no known cure for AIPS, some health authorities are working cautiously towards the theory that making information freely available may be a way of quelling the virus carrying tittle-tattle, which is believed to be the silly sickness's main cause. And although the Daily Mirror are taking the piss here, which they're very good at as a tabloid, it's actually quite refreshing so early on, February 1985, that the Daily Mirror is really stating the facts and is trying to stop the spread of the panic and the stigma. It's just bizarre that they just didn't maintain that as the decade went on and decades thereafter. But, Anyhow, at the top of that article, they mentioned a demand made by, quote, Swansea Theatre's Mrs. Mopps to have gay actors banned from their stage. And that appeared in the same newspaper, the Daily Mirror, 3 days earlier on the 19th of February 1985, where they ran the headline, Mrs. Mopps Rebel Over a Gay Plague, where they reported, theatre cleaners are threatening to boycott a group of gay actors because they are frightened of catching AIDS. 8 Mrs. Mopps have told their bosses they are, quote, unhappy, end quote, about working with the gay sweatshop performers at the Taliesin Theatre in Swansea. The London-based group have been booked to stage their production, Poppies, at the theatre tonight and tomorrow. Both performances will have to be called off if the cleaners go ahead with their threatened ban. Theatre director Alex Scott, who has offered the cleaners rubber gloves and disinfectant to carry on working, said last night, quote, they have overreacted. I have tried to resolve the problem by explaining that you only catch AIDS from sexual contact. The chances of sex between the cleaners and the actors is remote, to say the least, end quote. Gay sweatshop playwright Noel Grieg said he was, quote, extremely distressed, end quote, by the row. Quote, there is absolutely no risk, he said. And in relation to that very serious case of AIPS, AIDS-induced panic syndrome, there was no follow-up that I could find as to whether the production went ahead or not. Given the gay sweatshop was a prominent theatre company at the time, had their shows not gone ahead, I can only assume that the press would have covered the protest by gay rights groups. And, boy, did the gays love a good protest in the 1980s. But what I did find was incredibly sad, yet highlights the AIPS pandemic, where Bristol's Evening Post, the following month on the 28th of March 1985, ran the headline, A £600 Gamble on Gay Play, where they reported, Bristol's old profanity showboat is gambling £600 on a bid to help Britain's best-known gay theatre company, whose future is threatened by the AIDS scare. Gay sweatshop are backed by the Great London Council on the basis of the audiences they get. They were on a national tour which included venues offering a guaranteed fee, plus a few like the old profanity, which were regarded as risk ventures, that is, reliant on the number of people who turned up. The troupe hit the national headlines when a cleaning lady in Cardiff refused to sweep the stage after them in case she picked up AIDS. Within days, and despite desperate denials, the tour crumbled as venue after venue panicked. Old profanity supremo Pam Longfellow, already incensed with some of the scare stories about AIDS, was told gay sweatshop couldn't afford to appear on the boat now the guaranteed dates had been cancelled. Quote, I was furious and very depressed, she said. Gay sweatshop have been around for some time and are very respected. They are not just a bunch of gays poncing around on a stage. I was so angry about some of the Sun-type stories that I phoned the company and said we would guarantee 2 nights in Bristol. It was the least I could do. End quote. The gay sweatshop will be on the old profanity on Monday and Tuesday with Poppies, a show about growing old and being in love. The visit will cost £600, which Pam has guaranteed to find. Quote, I have got to try like hell to get people on board to see them now, she said. Oh, well done, Pam. And here in the UK, as early as 1982, doctors and government officials urged the public not to panic regarding this new emerging AIDS crisis, emphasising the routes of transmission that are still recognised today. But despite these efforts, fear and misinformation continued to spread, particularly as 1985 unfolded, marked by tragic events that brought the issue to the forefront of public consciousness. The deaths of those we've featured in previous episodes, such as John Lewis, the electronic music composer, and the case involving the likes of prison chaplain Reverend Gregory Richards and Christopher Egner, who unknowingly donated blood while HIV positive, their untimely deaths significantly heightened anxiety by the tabloid press. The press and the lurid stories they ran being one of the major sources of AIPS, AIDS-induced panic syndrome. This unsettling atmosphere was encapsulated by the Liverpool Daily Post on the 22nd of February 1985, which reported on the frustration of healthcare professionals with the headline, AIDS Panic Out of Control, Say Doctors, reflecting the urgent need of accurate information amidst widespread misfortune and fear, where the article states, doctors yesterday made a determined bid to explode the myths around the killer disease AIDS. In an attempt to quell the public alarm and hysteria that has arisen, one said, quote, the myths about AIDS are multiplying faster than the disease itself, end quote. Consultant physician Dr. Jonathan Turner warned, quote, it is ridiculous, it's getting out of control, end quote. Doctors came together to set straight the record on AIDS, which has so far killed 51 of its 118 British victims. They stressed again that by far the biggest risk groups are promiscuous homosexuals, drug addicts using syringes, and patients undergoing contaminated blood transfusions. Well, I'd imagine patients are undergoing blood transfusions, they don't know they're contaminated. Anyhow, ordinary social contact between a sufferer and another person is not likely to transmit the virus, they pointed out. And there are no ways in which it simply, quote, leaps from one person to another, end quote. There is no evidence that saliva can be a source of infection. The virus is passed only with, quote, close personal contact, such as sexual intercourse. Dr. Malcolm Tuddenham, vice chairman of the Regional Health Authority covering Bournemouth, said, quote, persecution of homosexuals could well be counterproductive. They are under the spotlight, but they have to feel confident about coming for treatment and receiving sympathetic care. There is a real possibility some homosexuals may not cooperate with us, faced with the prospect that the disease may cause them to be shunned by the public. Dr. Anthony Pinchin, consultant in clinical immunology and senior lecturer at St. Mary's Hospital London, who has cared for 40 AIDS patients, said, quote, behind this disease are people who are very sick, and they need our sympathy, our care, and understanding. AIDS victims were not a danger to other people, he said, and, when well, could return to normal life and work. They are not a risk to the community. They are very ill patients who have a very short lifespan, but they do have months, and in many cases years, where they can live a normal life, and we would like them to do so, he said. Then, on the 8th of March 1985, ITV aired their current affairs show, The London Programme, with the following summary. Is London's large homosexual community suffering from AIDS panic? Tonight's report looks at disturbing cases of gays banned from pubs, losing their homes and finding their jobs threatened. Now, I've tried to locate a copy of this episode, but sadly, we've no luck. But fear not, the press continued to lap up the epidemic of AIPS, AIDS-induced panic syndrome. Whereas the summary alluded, on the 8th of February 1985, the Liverpool Post ran the headline, Pub Bars Gays in AIDS Alarm, where the article states, a Liverpool pub owner has barred homosexuals because he fears they will spread the disease AIDS. The ban has angered Liverpool's gay community. The ban has angered Liverpool's gay community and was labelled, quote, grotesque, end quote, by health experts. Joe Farley, who owns several clubs and pubs in the city, is putting up signs warning that homosexuals are no longer welcome. He says he is taking the action to protect his customers from the AIDS virus, which has been nicknamed the gay plague. Quote, we are in the city centre, and the area is a highly populated gay area, he said. Quote, we know most of the gay lads in the city, and I just hope they will respect my wishes until this thing is cleared up. A lot of people I have spoken to in the city are afraid they are going to catch something off a beer glass or whatever, end quote. A spokesman for the Campaign for Homosexual Equality said, quote, we deplore any attempts to stir up witch hunts against gay people on the basis of alarming scare stories. Dr. John Ashton, head of the health promotion team of Mersey Regional Health Authority, said, quote, there is an undesirable level of hysteria and panic about AIDS at the moment. It is obviously something about which people are concerned, but to panic in this way, when there hasn't, to our knowledge, been one case of AIDS in a homosexual in Liverpool is fairly grotesque, end quote. The only known AIDS victim in Liverpool so far is a woman who caught the disease last year. Oh, mind-blowing. But over a week later, on the 20th of February 1985, the Liverpool Echo reported. City pub damaged. Liverpool City Centre pub, recently at the centre of a storm over a gaze ban, was hit by fire today. Firemen who fought the blaze at Shanks Bar in Manchester Street have ruled out arson. The fire severely damaged the bar and stereo equipment. Earlier this month, a row broke out after the pub's owner, Mr. Joe Farley, banned gaze from Shanks Bar. Well, I think if the fire brigade ruled out arson, then I guess it must have been karma. While Mr. Farley and his ban on gaze in his pubs and clubs made the newspapers up and down the country, this was not an isolated incident. Because 3 days prior to Mr. Farley's ban reaching the newspapers, the Aldershot Mail, on their front page, ran the headline, Club AIDS Ban on Gay Member. And, brace yourself, because they reported, a self-confessed homosexual has been banned from his local working men's club amid unfounded fears that he could pass on the killer virus AIDS. Mr. Mike Murphy, 23, claims he was ordered to leave the Cove Ivy Leaf Club in Cove Road on Sunday night after he popped in for a drink with his live-in lover, Mr. John Mahoney, 21. Mike, who runs his own public relations company and lives at Sandy Lane, Cove, says he was confronted by senior club officials who asked if he was, quote, gay. He said, quote, I don't publicise the fact that I am gay, but I am not ashamed of it. If someone asks me, I tell them. I admitted I was gay. And the president, Mr. Ken Brown, said he would have to ask me to leave. He said there had been complaints that people were frightened in the club over the AIDS thing. He said that the fact of the matter was that if I was gay, there was a risk of AIDS, and he was not prepared to subject his members to that, end quote. Now a furious Mike, who has been a club member for 5 years, is threatening to take legal action over the ban, which has also angered the Department of Health. Yesterday, a health department spokesman in London told the news, experience in the USA indicates there is no evidence of the disease having been acquired through casual contact with persons with AIDS living in the community. He added, the prime concern is to make sure that people who have actually got AIDS have not spread it further, and that is why we issued a leaflet last week with important information to blood donors, but you really can't legislate for the fears of irrational people who are not at risk. The dreaded virus, acquired immune deficiency syndrome, can be transmitted sexually or through blood transfusions. It was first discovered in America, but the disease has claimed a number of lives in Britain, including that of prison chaplain, the Reverend Gregory Richards, who died last week. Yesterday, Mike said, quote, I had a medical checkup only a month ago, and I certainly haven't got AIDS. The club thinks the disease could be spread by using the same glasses and plates as me, and the toilets. It's ridiculous. I'm not going to let them get away with this. I can't let it rest because they could submit others to this sort of indignity. In future, anyone who applies for membership of this club could well be asked a supplementary question when they go before the committee. Are you gay? If they reply yes, they will be banned. Mike, who says he knows of one other gay person who uses the club, went on, quote, if they back down now, I want a written apology and a notice posted in the club, end quote. Club secretary Mr. Aubrey Peters said the matter was being dealt with by the club president. He said, quote, I don't want to talk to the papers, but although we are an affiliated club, we have our own rules, and any officer of the club can ask anyone to leave at any time, end quote. Mr. Brown was unavailable for comment, and that article is accompanied with a photograph of Mike Murphy and lover John Mahoney. Then, on the 14th of February 1985, the Aldershot Mail ran the headline, Club Ban Victim Must Wait, where they give us this additional insight. The issue was due to be discussed by the club committee on Monday night, but the meeting was abandoned when President Mr. Ken Brown, the man who gave Mr. Murphy his marching orders, took ill and collapsed. Oh gosh, what a drama queen. Then on the 1st of March 1985, in the same newspaper, the Aldershot Mail, under the front page headline, "Gay couple in AIDS row expelled from club," go on to report, "Two self-confessed homosexuals at the centre of the Farnborough AIDS row have been banned for life from a working men's club. Cove Ivy Leaf Club was plunged into controversy when Mike Murphy, 23, and his live-in lover, John Mahoney, 21, were barred from the premises in Cove Road. Mr. Murphy, who runs his own public relations company and lives in Sandy Lane, Cove, claims he was confronted by club officials who asked if he was, quote, gay. Mr. Murphy admitted he was and says he was then ordered to leave the club by officials who were worried about the possibility of AIDS being passed on to other members. Farnborough and Cove branch of the Labour Party, of which Mr. Murphy is a member, wrote to the club asking for him to be reinstalled and for an apology. They claimed the ban was, quote, inexcusable. Club Secretary Mr. Aubrey Peters told the Labour Party that both Mr. Murphy and Mr. Mahoney were club members, that they were not expelled from the club, but, quote, merely asked to leave the club until an investigation had been carried out in connection with medical treatment which they were having at Frimley Park Hospital, end quote. The letter said, quote, this was done to allay the fears of members of this club. This was in no way an expulsion. But at a committee meeting on Monday night, officials voted to ban Mr. Mahoney and Mr. Murphy for life. Mr. Peters said, quote, they have been expelled from the club for bringing the club into disrepute. They have been barred for life, end quote. Mr. Peters denied it was connected with the AIDS fear. Afterwards, an angry Mr. Murphy said he planned to take legal action against the club over the ban. Quote, I have never misconducted myself in that club or brought it into disrepute. They know the real reason why I have been banned and realise it was an error. They are now trying to backtrack and look for another excuse. End quote. Mr. Murphy said he has been receiving medical treatment at Frimley Park, but for an hereditary heart ailment. And from that story on the front page of the newspaper, merely turn the page and on page 2 is the following article. New team to combat AIDS fears. Recent scares over the killer disease AIDS has led to the setting up of a new information committee. At the head of the team is self-confessed homosexual Mr. Mike Murphy, who was banned from a local working men's club amid unfounded fears that he could pass on AIDS. Mr. Murphy of Sandy Lane, Cove, has set up the committee with the aim of issuing accurate information through the media. He hopes this approach will calm what he sees as the hysterical treatment of the AIDS problem. Quote, over the past few weeks, we have been fed with scaremongering headlines and stories, said Mr. Murphy, who runs his own public relations company. Quote, this sort of thing can only lead to a backlash against the gay community as a whole. As a result, years of hard work in breaking down anti-gay barriers in every sphere of the social spectrum will be destroyed. Mr. Murphy believes that many of the reports concerning the disease are misinformed, and a form of coordination between informed groups and medical specialists is long overdue. He has now got together the Coordinated AIDS Response Committee, which has held its first meeting. Among the members are representatives from the British Haemophilia Society, London Gay Switchboard, and the Gay Press. Gosh, go Mike. Then, by the 23rd of July 1985, the Aldershot Mail runs the following headline. Club reinstate banned gay pair, where they report, two homosexuals who were banned from a working men's club amid unfounded fears that they could spread AIDS have won their battle to be reinstated. Mike Murphy, 23, and his friend John Mahoney, 21, now plan to return to the club 5 months after sparking a row which made national headlines. Cove Ivy Leaf Club agreed to reinstate the two men's membership at a club and institute union arbitration panel held at another club to hear the men's appeal against the expulsions. Witnesses attended to give evidence, but the club agreed to reinstate the men before the appeal began. Six Ivy Leaf Club committee members hurried from the meeting in Blackwater, leaving drinks unfinished after the panel ordered that the two men be reinstated, quote, forthwith. Mr. Murphy, who has moved from Sandy Lane Cove to Home Park Road, Wimbledon, said, quote, I feel I have been vindicated. I greatly look forward to visiting the club in the near future, when I will be pleased to buy the president and his cronies a drink and hope they drown in it. Mr. Murphy said he did not attend the meeting which won back his membership after missing a flight back from a holiday in Ibiza, but John Mahoney was present. The pair had been banned from the club for life at a meeting in February. The pair have moved to London, where Mr. Murphy is job hunting. At the club in Cove Road, Cove, Mr. Aubrey Peters, the secretary, declined to talk about the reinstatement. The club was also ordered to pay £50 costs for the arbitration panel meeting. Cove Ivy Leaf Club is affiliated to the CIU in common with working men's clubs all over the country. Failure to comply with a ruling could mean expulsion from the CIU and loss of other benefits of membership. Oh, what absolute palaver, but well done Mike and John for sticking at it and not giving up. And again, it just serves as another example, another perfect example of APES, AIDS-induced panic syndrome. And another example, again from February 1985, I told you it was a busy month for APES, the Sunday Mirror on the 10th of February 1985 on their front page ran the headline, Burn All Your Clothes, Shocker AIDS Hospital. Where, they go on to report, panic swept through a hospital where an AIDS victim died when staff were given the chilling order, quote, burn your clothes and have an urgent blood test, end quote. A furious union chief claimed it was 48 hours before staff were warned there was a suspected AIDS patient in the hospital at Dulwich, South East London. He stormed, quote, it is a scandal. Staff have been put at enormous risk, end quote. Mr. Derek Banks of the National Union of Public Employees said the grim, quote, burn your clothes, end quote, order was given to a cleaner who tidied the patient's room and a porter who pushed him about in a wheelchair. Mr. Banks said, quote, the cleaner is in a terrible state, wondering whether she has contracted the disease. She is very worried and confused. Cleaners and porters were around the victims without wearing protective clothing, end quote. The patient, in his late 20s, died last Tuesday and was Britain's 53rd AIDS death. His body is now stored in the hospital mortuary, wrapped in plastic bags behind locked doors. Hospital officials have refused to name the man, thought to be a homosexual from the Midlands, at the request of his parents. He was admitted to a general ward with other patients 11 days ago. At first, he was thought to be suffering from pneumonia. Later, he was moved to a room of his own. After official confirmation that he was suspected of having AIDS, all staff who went near him wore disposable gowns, masks and gloves. MPs last night demanded that the dead man should be named. Dulwich's Conservative MP, Gerald Bowden, said, quote, in the circumstances it would be better for all concerned. Perhaps his name could be released to a limited number of GP and health workers in the area. If anyone approached a local doctor and perhaps had AIDS symptoms, then the doctor could ask, do you know this man? The Department of Health and Social Security has issued guidelines to hospitals dealing with suspected cases. A spokesman said, quote, the patient should be isolated. All staff who come into contact with him should wear disposable masks, gloves and overalls. We also believe staff should be informed that there is a suspected AIDS case in the hospital. End quote. Oh, even for 1985, the situation surrounding AIDS was undeniably over the top. While the UK may have been slower to respond than the United States, the knowledge gained from American research about the transmission routes of the virus became invaluable, because by 1982 and 1983, the UK press coverage began disseminating the critical information, outlining the primary modes of transmission, sexual contact, and the exchange of bodily fluids, notably excluding saliva. This information, stark and alarming at the time, remains relevant to this day, highlighting both the urgency of awareness and the impact of effective communications during a public health crisis. But this advice clearly hadn't reached Bournemouth, where on the 20th of February 1985, the Daily Echo ran the headline, "Tattooist Bans Homosexuals," where the article states, "A pool tattoo artist has started a ban on homosexuals in his studio as a precaution against the deadly disease AIDS. Quote, I want to safeguard myself as well as my customers," explained Mike Lee, who operates from the Old Town Market in the town centre. "A small amount of blood comes out of the punctures made by needles as designs are painted indelibly on the skin. Tattooists are worried in case they prick themselves by accident while working on a victim of AIDS. Quote, I wear surgical gloves, but they are not very strong. I am very vulnerable because I handle blood," explained Mike, a tattoo artist for 16 years. Quote, customers are totally safe because everything is thoroughly sterilised, but it is a risk for me. End quote. Oh, another classic case of apes. AIDS-induced panic syndrome, but to a degree I can see his concern between a customer who knows or doesn't know their HIV status, especially when you're working so closely with needles and blood. But my question is, how would he have screened his customers to know if they were gay?
Oh, now don't be like that, matron.
So, we've heard a few instances of apes, AIDS-induced panic syndrome, hitting the UK. Well, the Oregon newspaper in the United States on the 16th of November 1985 reported a Dr. Silverman who highlighted apes is just as concerning as AIDS itself, where they report under the headline, "Education said key to halt AIDS spread." And the article states, "AIDS is a disease of consenting adults that can be contained by education and information," the former San Francisco Director of Health told the City Club of Portland Friday. Quote, "You won't get AIDS if you don't place yourself in a situation for getting AIDS," said Dr. Mervyn F. Silverman, whose 7.5-year tenure included the period of the diagnosis of the first AIDS case in San Francisco and the subsequent rise of the disease there. Quote, "If we did a good job of educating, we could literally stop the spread of AIDS tomorrow," he said. Since 1981, San Francisco has had about 1,310 AIDS patients, of which almost half have died. The city reports 2 new diagnosed cases of AIDS every day. Since January, there has been 1 AIDS death per day. Silverman, who quit the San Francisco job January the 15th and has opened a consulting firm, emphasised that AIDS was spread through intimate sexual contact with infected persons, or by the blood products of an infected person entering the body, not by casual social contact. Quote, "There are 2 epidemics," Silverman said. Quote, "One is the tragic disease AIDS, acquired immune deficiency syndrome, and the other is APS, AIDS-induced panic syndrome," he said. "Nationally, about half of the patients who develop AIDS have died of infections or Kaposi sarcoma, a rare form of cancer." In Oregon, 51 AIDS cases have been diagnosed since 1981 and 18 people with AIDS have died. Homosexual men are the biggest risk of contracting AIDS, a profound weakening of the body's immune system, and Silverman was criticised by San Francisco's homosexual community when he tried to close down the city's gay bathhouses. Silverman said the current anxiety over AIDS had been raised by the death of actor Rock Hudson and the issue of AIDS-infected children in classrooms. Silverman is critical of programs that would isolate people at risk for AIDS or those who have AIDS. Quote, "Viruses don't differentiate between sexes," Silverman said. "Heterosexuals are not immune to putting themselves at risk." And on the 16th of January 1986, in the state of Indiana, the Muncie Evening Press report on some people living with AIDS and health specialists addressing a University Hall audience on the facts of how AIDS is transmitted. The article also gives a quote from Indiana State Board of Health AIDS Coordinator Deborah Taylor, who emphasised the state was battling AIDS as well as AIDS. Quote, That's AIDS-induced panic syndrome. You can touch people with AIDS. You can have dinner with them. You can eat at a restaurant and be served by a gay waiter, Taylor said. And like any plague or virus, it mutates, and so does apes, as we learn in Ohio's Akron Beacon Journal, who report on the AIDS seminar taking place on the 26th of January 1985, where they reported, "Understanding how difficult it is to spread the virus is the key to calming the hysteria surrounding AIDS," said Dr. Brian Davis, a Cleveland physician. He couldn't help but satirize the irrational fear many people have concerning AIDS. Quote, "I call it afraids," Davis said of the hysteria, "acute fear related to AIDS." Another physician referred to the panic epidemic as apes or AIDS-induced panic syndrome. Quote, "There are many foolish things people do to get AIDS," Davis said. "Sticking a used syringe in your arm is stupid, but you cannot get AIDS from normal, casual, everyday contact in the home or at work." So there you have it. We have afraids and apes. So now we have a triple whammy. We have AIDS, afraids and apes. It's spreading. Anyhow, back in the UK and the year prior, 1985, on the 28th of July, the Sunday Mirror, a tabloid newspaper, ran the front page headline, "John Blasts Sins of Hollywood," with the strapline, "Dynasty Star on AIDS Panic," where the Mirror reports, "Panic over the killer sex disease AIDS is sweeping Hollywood, as movie heartthrob Rock Hudson, who has the gay plague, who was fighting for his life in a Paris hospital, the torture of Tinseltown was summed up by superstar Joan Collins. Dynasty dazzler Joan," Rock also appeared in the soap, "revealed her feelings as the hysteria over AIDS reached fever pitch. She said, quote, it was fine to have sexual freedom, but it has been abused. AIDS and the other sex disease herpes have come as the great plague to teach us all a lesson." Joan, who has just finished filming a new miniseries called Sins, added, quote, there's a moral laxity around. It's like the Roman Empire. Judy Spiegel, a spokesman for the Los Angeles AIDS Project, which helps victims, said, quote, our phones are being swamped with calls from people, many in the entertainment industry, who fear they have AIDS. Judy revealed that other prominent members of show business are suffering from AIDS, but refused to name them. It is now known that AIDS, which destroys the body's natural defences, can be passed on by contaminated blood transfusions and by artificial insemination. Previously, it was thought to be transmitted only during intimate homosexual contact. Prominent Hollywood gossip columnist Amy Archer said, quote, a lot of people are very worried about AIDS, end quote. Joan, who is engaged to Peter Holm, has told friends she is, quote, terrified by the spread of the new sex diseases. She said, quote, I now realise the risks I took in my earlier years. I never smoke a cigarette from someone's lips or even a drink from someone's glass anymore. I've reached the point where there are more important things than making love once a week on the kitchen table. For one, for one night's pleasure, you could pay with your life. Oh, Joan, the kitchen table. I thought she was a classy lady. Oh, but blimey, won't share a cigarette or drink from someone's glass. That's, I think Joan's got a serious case of the apes there. The AIDS-induced panic syndrome. Another case of apes that'll either make you roll your eyes or giggle with despair was reported on the 21st of November 1986 in Nottingham's Evening Post under the headline Swim Pool AIDS Fear. And the article states, ready? Worried parent. Oh, sorry. Worried parents. Start again. Worried parents are to look for another pool where their children can swim. If controversial, it's, you know, it's not funny, but it's just so stupid. It's making me giggle. Right. Worried parents are to look for another. Worried parents are to look for another pool where their children can swim if controversial Sunday swimming sessions for the gay and lesbian community go ahead. The sessions at the John Carroll Leisure Centre, Radford, are due to begin this Sunday, but parents of pupils who attend the nearby Douglas Primary School in Seeley Road are anxious about their children catching AIDS. Oh dear. Oh, have you ever heard anything so ridiculous? Oh, but, all right, come on. They say, They say they will keep the children away from the weekly lessons until they are sure there is no risk of catching the killer disease. Mohammed Sharif, a governor at the school, said, quote, "There is genuine concern among the parents about the risks. They want an expert to come and reassure them that the children will be safe." Oh, deep breath. I've asked the headmaster to look for another pool. The City Council's Equal Opportunities Officer says, quote, "It is impossible to catch AIDS through water," end quote. The council gave the go-ahead for the 1.5-hour gay sessions last month. Nearly half the 565 AIDS cases in the UK are in the North West Thames Heath Authority area. There are 8 cases in the Trent region. Oh, do you know, you'd think the parents and school governor, Mohammed Sharif, would welcome the private sessions for gays and lesbians to swim, given how at the time, in the 80s, what was this, 1986, there was this unfound belief that all gay men were child molesterers. Anyhow, the matter creates a storm locally, and we get to hear of a follow-up when the story is once again splashed in the Evening Post. See what I did there? On the 2nd of December 1986, under the headline, "Swimming, Gay Sessions Go On." Without further ado, let's dive right in. See, I'm wasted here. I really am. Oh, gosh, deep breath. Are you ready? Here we go. Nottingham's controversial gay-only swimming sessions will continue, councillors have been told. Amid parents' fears that their children might catch the killer disease AIDS, Tories demanded at yesterday's full city council meeting that the sessions be scrapped. Tory leader Councillor Bill Bradbury said 10 Nottingham schools have dropped swimming lessons because of the gays. However, Leisure Services Chairman Councillor Mrs Frances Dennett said the sessions will go on. The ruling Labour group, with the exception of 2 members, defended the right of gays to have private swimming meetings. They insisted there is no health risk and homosexuals had the same rights as any group of people to use council facilities. Councillor Charles Clark asked whether the decision to use Radford's John Carroll Leisure Centre was appropriate in view of the great concern expressed by groups who use the pool. And there were more questions on the last-minute transfer of the Sunday sessions to the Victoria Leisure Centre, Sneaton. Attendants have refused to supervise them because they say homosexual swimmers should not be given special treatment. But Mrs. Dennett said the council had checked with the government's AIDS unit. Quote, "There is no report or knowledge of the transmission of AIDS through swimming pool water," she said. Quote, "AIDS is spread by intercourse with an infected partner, by infected blood and the use of infected needles by drug users," end quote. Chemicals used in city pools were also sufficient to destroy any microbes. Quote, "Swimming pools are vast reservoirs of water in comparison to the AIDS virus, which is microscopic. The lesbians and gays have not been given special treatment. As a social group, they are entitled to their own swimming sessions, as any group requesting the same facility," she added. But she refused to answer Councillor Ted Hickey, who asked... But she refused to answer Councillor Ted Hickey... Ted Hickey. Oh dear. Is this story just completely made up? But she refused to answer Councillor Ted Hickey, who asked who was going to subsidise the sessions. He claimed £36 was taken on Sunday. I think in 1986 that's a lot of money, no? Councillor Bradbury said his party was not trying to take advantage of the AIDS scare. Quote, "But this is intolerable for the people of Nottingham. They are frightened," he said. Labour's councillor Richard McCance said he was proud to be gay and accused councillor Bradbury of victimisation. However, two Labour members criticised the sessions. Councillor Mrs Linda Phillips claimed it was causing, quote, unnecessary antagonism, end quote, towards homosexuals, while Councillor Dennis Birkinshaw warned that swimmers were staying away from the Victoria's pool. Oh, because I don't want to catch it. It's... oh my God, you can't make it up. So, classic case of apes, AIDS-induced panic syndrome there. However, this discourse becomes entangled with wider societal issues, particularly when considering the stigma surrounding apes that largely overshadows AIDS itself. The distressing reality is exemplified by harrowing accounts that emerged, such as the one reported by the Chatham Standard on the 17th of November 1987, which detailed an appalling incident where a vulnerable individual was attacked under the horrific pretext of having AIDS, where the front page headline states, "Fugs said I had AIDS," with the strapline, "Seven stone man's attack ordeal in pub," and the article states, "A man thought to be an AIDS victim and weighing less than 7 stone was savagely beaten up in a Medway pub, a court was told yesterday. The two attackers followed Darren Hickford, who has a rare muscle-wasting disease, to a lavatory where he was repeatedly kicked and punched. Mr. Hickford, aged 21, who weighs 6 stone 10 pounds, suffers from a condition similar to muscular dystrophy. Father of four, Richard Carley, 29, of Cormorant Close, Stroud, admitted causing actual bodily harm to Mr. Hickford at the Coach and Horses pub in Stroud in June. Mr. Samuel Balsh, prosecuting, told Medway magistrates Mr. Hickford overheard the two men in the pub saying they thought he had AIDS. Mr. Hickford, who does not have AIDS but is very thin because of his illness, got up to go to the lavatory and was followed by the two men. Carley grabbed him by the throat and began banging his head against the wall. He was kicked to the floor. The other man continued the attack after telling Carley he had done enough. Mr. Balch said the victim lived near the second man's parents in Stroud and there were some difficulty in the street. Mr. Alan Derling, defending, said Carley, a self-employed asphalt layer, did not know his victim was suffering from the muscle disease. He denied kicking Mr. Hickford but was deeply ashamed. He and his friend had been drinking all day. Mr. Derling said Carley was living with his mother after separating from his wife. He was told he could no longer see his children. Carley was given a 6-month jail term suspended for 2 years and was ordered to pay Mr. Hickford £125 compensation and £25 court costs. Another man accused of assaulting Mr. Hickford failed to turn up at court and a warrant was issued. Oh, just truly sickening. And that sentencing did elicit outrage, not least from Darren's mother, Irene, who voiced her dismay in the Medway News on the 20th of November 1987, under the striking headline, "Assault Victim's Mother Criticises Leniency to Fug. Attacker Said Disabled Son Had AIDS." And the article states, "A mother has criticised magistrates for their lenient sentence on a fug who savagely beat up her disabled son in a Medway pub. Mrs. Irene Hickford says the attacker, who was said to have thought 21-year-old Darren had AIDS, should have been jailed. Father of four, Richard Carley, was given a 6-month suspended sentence and ordered to pay £125 to Darren, the victim of a rare muscle-wasting disease. Darren weighs just 6 stone 10 pounds because of his condition, which is similar to muscular dystrophy. He does not have AIDS." Mrs. Hickford said, quote, "My husband and I went to the court to see what sort of person would do this. We are both disgusted with the sentence. He got off very lightly. He should have got at least 6 months inside," end quote. Mrs. Hickford said that following his ordeal, Darren would be selling his terraced home in Watling Street, Stroud, and moving back to the family home at Chalk Village, Gravesend. Oh, what a heartbreaking attack, and oh, absolute scum, the pair of them. And I did find Darren's family online, but sadly I could find no trace of Darren to find out what happened to him next. But oh gosh, poor lad. So there you have it. Apes, AIDS-induced panic syndrome. which was so much bigger than some of the stories we've covered in this episode. There are so many more in the newspaper archives, and I strongly suspect so many that didn't get reported at all. To a degree, those that suffered from AIDS could be forgiven. After all, those who lived through the AIDS pandemic and more recently the COVID-19 pandemic can testify that panic is a common response when faced with the unknown. However, one must question whether AIDS remained excusable as the years progressed and the consistent efforts of government, experts, doctors and communities who clarified the facts surrounding HIV/AIDS and its modes of transmission. This raises a critical inquiry. Was AIDS purely a reaction to the unknown, or was it, as we have heard, influenced by underlying homophobia, religious bias or other forms of prejudice? Additionally, an important aspect of AIDS that was mentioned but not explored was the phenomenon of individuals being dismissed from their jobs, which we will delve into in the next episode. You can check out and read all the newspaper articles mentioned in this episode, along with extra snippets of information, on the Extra Tea blog. You can find the link in the show notes. If you've enjoyed this episode, then don't forget to like, share and subscribe. Until the next episode, you can find me on Instagram at The Lost Boys of Soho.